Hailing all content creators, have you been looking for a new place to host your music and podcast content, or are you ready to start? Check out Disktopia. It is a streaming-first platform for creatives without all the fuss. You can upload, manage, and distribute your content, whether it is music or podcasts. With Disktopia, they allow you creative freedom for your podcast with integrated merch as a trustworthy content creator platform. You can upload it all in one place, and then you can set your content to be downloadable or even stream only. The Disktopia platform allows content to be distributed via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, Amazon Music, Deezer, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Radio Public, Savant, Stitcher, and Facebook, designed for dreamers, powered by fans. Get started today by visiting Disktopia.com. Link is also in the show notes below. The following podcast is a Super Network production with your hosts, Super Marcy.
Yeah, definitely a step up, but, you know, that could be perhaps maybe the script just worked. Maybe it was just the fact that it had Eric Roberts being all Eric Roberts-y.
The terrible Australian, B. Jermaine.
Why doesn't the vampire just leave? It's not like that he's being held there against his will. And we've seen him a few times on top of built-on roofs. Like, why does he just piss off and leave?
It contains coarse and explicit language.
The housemate dude, I was like, why the f*** are you dressed like Constantine? That was just weirding out the whole time.
Mature themes.
You know, it's your wedding day and everyone always has cold feet and they sort of, this is kind of more the extreme version of that kind of scenario. Like, should I marry a serial killer or not?
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
For more, please visit supermarcy.com and show your support at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy the show.
Projectionist. A curator of 100 years of nightmares. Trapped in a silver screen that never forgets. Welcome to my nightmare.
Hello everyone and welcome to Podcasters of Horror. This is the podcast where we look at TV shows and films that are horror anthologies. And so far, we have covered the Showtime series Masters of Horror, and last episode, we finished the one season of Fear Itself. I am your host, Super Marcy, and this is episode 20, I think?
I believe it is.
Yes, thank you. And as you could hear, my regular co-host for Podcasters, the one who is terrible, Bede Jermaine. Hello, Bede.
Hi, Marcy. How are you?
I'm doing very well, very well. Thank you. And we have finished Fear Itself.
Indeed.
And we are on to the last portion of some Mick Garris, at least for now. As today's episode, we will be covering Nightmare Cinema. And we are not alone on this episode because our good friend and regular guest to Podcasters, the one and only killer horror critic, Matt Konopka. Welcome and thank you.
Woo! Hello, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Now go away. No, I'm kidding.
Okay, all right. See you later.
We just wanted that. We just wanted the clout. Like,
nah. I understand.
No. And how are you? What's new in the killer horror critic world?
Oh, beautiful. Just nothing but wonder. No, really, it's all awful, but you know, it's fine. I'm here now, so
yeah. See, you only enjoy yourself when you come into a podcast with Bede and I.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Talking some Nightmare Cinema. I can't imagine a better time to spend my day.
Yes. Yes. For me, with Nightmare Cinema, I had not seen it. So watching it for prep for this episode was the first time I'd seen it. And I believe the both of you have seen it before.
Indeed.
Oh, I'm very curious what you thought then.
Yes. Yes, indeed. But Bid, you are the information man on the Super Network. So please give us all the info for the listeners as well for Nightmare Cinema.
Indeed. Well, Nightmare Cinema, of course, was an anthology horror film that was released in 2018. And this film was spearheaded by Mick Garris himself as to be kind of like a kind of a feature film version of Masters of Horror. The same type of key elements that made Masters of Horror as such a good show as it is. You know, getting some well-renowned horror directors, getting them to come in and contribute a segment to the film. But, you know, compared to Masters of Horror, which an episode is like an hour long, some of the segments kind of range between 12 to 20 minutes, depending on the story they're telling. But it does have the kind of the same feel of Masters of Horror. So,
yes.
And so Mick Garris himself directed one of the segments as well as the wraparound. And he assembled quite an awesome team for this movie, which include directors such as Alejandro Berger. If I butchered his last name, please forgive me. Joe Dante, Ryohei Kitamura, and David Slade. So it's quite a collective mix of different variety of filmmakers from the horror genre coming together for this one anthology. And the plot summary for this one, or at least the main one anyway, is five strangers converge at a haunted movie theater owned by the projectionist. Once inside, the audience members witness a series of screenings showing them their deepest fears and darkest secrets over five tales.
Yes.
Yes, and we'll go through all the individual segments and then we'll do the wraparound as the very last one.
Well, I do like doing the wraparound last.
Yes.
Oh, wait a minute, this isn't After Dark. What am I doing?
That's a different type of wraparound, Marcy. But
yeah.
I'm not talking reach arounds here, Marcy.
Yeah, I was going to say, isn't it more like a reach around? But anyway.
Exactly. But we'll start with the very first segment of the film, which is called The Thing in the Woods. Now, this segment was written and directed by Alejandro Berger, and he's the director behind the horror comedy Juan of the Dead. And this one segment stars Eric Nelson, Sarah Winters, Kevin Fontenay, and Chris Warren. And the plot summary for this one is a postmodern send-up on slasher thrillers involving a killer who is not as he seems.
Mm.
Matt, since you have seen Masters of Horror before, what are your thoughts on The Thing in the Woods?
I'm going to be honest. I think this is my personal favorite segment in the entire movie. So, and I'll explain why. So, first of all, I'm a big fan of, is it Bruges? I think is how you're saying it. Yeah.
Yeah. I had to even listen back on Mick Garris's own podcast just to say how he pronounced the name. But even then, I probably pronounced it wrong. So,
I'm a dumb American, so I'm definitely not pronouncing it correctly. I'm a fan of Bruges. You mentioned One of the Dead. I really love his Puka Lives segment for the Into the Dark Hulu series, which was phenomenal. But what I like about this segment so much is that, one, it really sets the tone for the entire film, because what's interesting about most, if not all, of the shorts in it is that they all kind of use sort of a tropey sort of story, like, you know, the setup for many of these is not something that you haven't really seen before, but what becomes interesting is kind of the twist that everyone sort of puts on their little segment or their different sort of style. And with this, I just think it's such a cool, you know, as he describes, postmodern slasher, because we're sort of met with what we think is your typical average slasher film. And then by the end, you find out like, oh no, it's actually the killer that is like our final quote unquote boy our quote unquote final boy in this case. And he's going around trying to kill aliens. So I just remember seeing this for the first time and thinking like, you know, halfway through the segment, like, this is fun, but, you know, pretty whatever. Like, I'm having a good time. The kills are good, but, you know, nothing special. And then that twist comes around. It's like, holy shit, I did not see that coming. And I just think it's interesting because when I was watching this again, and I hadn't really thought about this before, is that, you know, when you actually kind of peel it back a little bit, even though it's this fun twist and everything, it's still kind of set up like if aliens had never crash landed near their campsite, I still feel like the kid who ends up becoming the welder would have gone on a killing spree anyway.
Yeah. Like
Like, it's kind of set up like, you know, he was going to do this regardless. And what happens is kind of an excuse, which I think is kind of cool, because he's got the and what made me think that is, you know, not only the hints like you would get in your average slasher film where the party's starting and the flashback and the kid kind of, you know, he looks at the boyfriend of the girl that he's obsessed with and he gives him this look of like, I fucking hate you, you know, and that's like the setup we would normally get these kind of things. But then when he's later killing that same boyfriend, you know, he doesn't just like kill him like, oh, I've got to take out the salient threat. He tortures the guy, you know, he's putting blade after blade after blade of him in him, fucking crucifies the guy, you know, like he's taking out his hatred for him. And so I just think that's kind of fun. It's like this twist and a twist and a twist where it subverts what you expect from the slasher genre, but then it also kind of plays into it as well and is itself sort of your average slasher. So I don't know if that makes sense, but but yeah, I just think it's a really clever short. I just think it's really fun and clever.
Awesome. And Marcy, since this is your first time watching Nightmare Cinema, what did you think of this segment?
Yeah, I actually had no idea on the tone or what any of Nightmare Cinema was. I went into it completely blank. And as this one's starting, I'm like, these performances are kind of crap. But I don't know if I like it or not. And then it takes a turn. I'm like, holy shit, that's really cool. But I still don't know. And then it does more. And I'm like, this is really goofy. And the more I thought about it, I'm like, that was kind of the point of what it was. So at first I was like, yeah, it's kind of, I don't know if I really liked it. But then as I thought about it more, and Beat and I kind of had a chat about it as well, and as hearing you, I'm like, yeah, you know, it was actually pretty solid. But I think what, like, once I picked up, yeah, it's kind of meant to be silly and subvert those expectations. I just think maybe it could have done a bit more. Something just for me personally felt missing. I don't know if it needed to be way more over the top or not, but yeah. And again,
already pretty over the top.
It is, but certain other things, like, I don't know. Like, I guess, well, it's a way of the tone more than anything else, because it does change tones as well. And then once it changes tones, the characters completely change. But it's like, okay, but was I looking at that from a different point of view? And now this is how this character views everyone, as they're an asshole, and this is why he just doesn't really, you know, he kind of enjoys killing them, even though he sort of has to, because it is like a spider alien invasion. Some of that, yeah, a little bit, maybe it was lost on me, I don't know. But yeah, as you've said, this guy probably would have been a mass killer without this alien invasion. I'm like, you know what, yes. And he would have been like an incel kind of
well, I'll just say, you know, yeah, I think it was kind of interesting, because, you know, if you take that concept and then you just look at the short through his point of view, you know, you can almost, it's almost sort of a way of like, kind of, yeah, maybe one way to look at it is like getting into the head of someone like, you know, Jason Voorhees or Michael Myers or whatever.
Yeah.
Where it almost makes you think for a second, like, you know, they're evil and they're bad, but, you know, is this kind of like how they see it sometimes, maybe, you know, because when you're the villain, you don't know you're the villain. You know, you're always the hero to your own story. So I think that, you know, the welder, I mean, you could argue that even though on the surface this is like an, you know, an alien invasion film, you could argue that another way to look at it in a slasher context is you're seeing through the eyes of like what these killers see. And, you know, you're kind of seeing it from his point of view of like, no, I'm doing the right thing, you know, killing all these horny teenagers.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I just think it's fun, but I do understand what you're saying, because the problem that I think I personally have with most of the shorts, as we'll discuss going on, is that they're all very basic in plot. You know, there's not, especially this one, you're just kind of thrown right into the middle of a chase and there's really no plots to it, you know? It's more of an experience.
And, so, and I guess as well, the other bit, and this kind of will go to with the reach, or I mean wraparounds, I didn't say that on purpose at all. Yes, I did. is that, and I suppose this kind of goes back to, and you can listen to our discussion on this on the King Zone when we discussed Quicksilver Highway, is that like, and this story, like,
it feels like there's meant to be a moral, but I didn't really feel like there was a moral, especially in terms of like who's watching the film in the Nightmare Cinema.
Yeah.
And that was kind of like, with Quicksilver Highway, it felt like, yeah, there's meant to be some kind of message, but it's not really there. And that's how it's kind of set up. And this felt very much the same. So,
And that's why I think there's a problem with plot, because you have your final girl, Samantha, played by Sarah Elizabeth Withers. And if you are looking at these stories as like morality tales, which of course they are, you know, they're short horror stories. They always tend to be. If you're looking at it as a morality tale, you know, and if you look at the Nightmare Cinema itself as being sort of a gateway to hell or whatever you want to call it, the afterlife, whatever. You have to ask yourself, what did Samantha do to like deserve her punishment? Because when you watch this, like the only thing you can really find, I think, that she quote unquote does is have a boyfriend.
Yeah.
You know, that the other guy
doesn't feel right, does it?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Mm. It feels like she's being punished for not being attracted to the dorky kid, her neighbor. Yeah. And that's where it falls apart a little bit, which is why I think it's most enjoyable if you just look at it through his eyes of like, no, he's a bad person and he's a killer. Yeah. But then like you said, it doesn't work once you actually have her in the theater being punished.
It's really, I found that like really bizarre. Like I could see it maybe on a level if it's saying like maybe you should have seen the warning signs that this guy
could be
gonna do this, but then again that's almost like victim blaming, and then that makes me feel ill. But you know what, we haven't heard much from Bede, so Bede,
indeed.
I don't care that you're recording in my spare room closet with all my laundry, but you know.
Yes, I was forced out. But anyways.
Right. That makes it sound mean. This was your choice.
Well, that was true. That is true. I had to do it for the sake of the recording. But anyways, I think overall, like I think, and we'll talk about this throughout most of the segments, I think for me, and I think with The Thing in the Woods, I did enjoy the segment overall because, you know, as a slasher fan, it's one of my favorite subgenres, so I'm just going to have a good time with it regardless. But I think for me, being that this is a two-hour film, and this one I think has the shortest of the running times of all the segments, I feel like there's definitely areas that they could have, you know, expanded upon a little bit more, because once the, like, I did love the twist, like, for the first half, you think, oh, it's just pretty much your regular slasher. And then once the twist comes in that the killer is killing all these, like, teens because they're infected by these alien spider creatures that pretty much, you know, infect, like, gets in their bodies and takes over. Like, I think that's a really cool idea, and I did enjoy, like, that aspect of the film. Mm. But at the same time, though, I feel like with, and this is something, again, I said before, we'll talk about, at least I have a problem with some of the other segments, is there's definitely areas they could have expanded upon or at least dived in a little bit more, but because there's just some things that just didn't quite make sense for me. Like, for example, though, like, we do have the character who is definitely, like, I do agree with both of you, regardless if there was an alien invasion or not, he probably was going to end up killing some of these people anyway. But I think when the alien spiders start infecting people, he just automatically thinks, oh, these things are taking over, I better start killing everyone. But we don't know what the alien spiders are. Are they friendly? Are they actually evil? We don't see them actually doing anything bad.
True.
As of yet. And maybe that's the whole thing we have all talked about in regards to maybe he already had that killer urge and this is a good excuse for him to wanting to kill everyone. And basically, he just didn't put any second thought into it. But that being said, though, I think the gore is pretty cool. There's some pretty creative kills throughout this segment, and there's some pretty funny bit of humor as well. I did love the, like, some of the gags that make me laugh. Like, I believe, and tell me if I'm wrong, there's a scene at the very beginning of the segment where Sarah Winthers falls down and lands on a body, and she keeps trying to get up from the body, but she just keeps falling down on it. I don't know why. That little moment just made me laugh.
Well, that's so great too, because that body, you see that the head has exploded from the inside out, and so it's kind of like a nice hint of what's to come, but you don't think about it the first time seeing it.
Yeah, and also I guess another thing too is, like, since this starts off at the middle of the story, like after the invasion happens, are all the teen characters, are they aware they're infected with alien spiders, or?
I don't think they knew they were, because when the twist comes and she finds out like who it is,
yeah,
she's not aware of what was actually happening. So yeah.
Plus the spider, I feel like itself kind of splits her head and is like, ha, motherfucker, fuck you, you know? Like,
yeah, it does that.
Like, I feel like the spider is in that moment saying, she doesn't fucking know, bitch.
Yeah, I feel like I that, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, definitely, I agree with that. but I think, like I said, there's definitely some areas that it could easily have been expanded upon. Like, I think what I find interesting about all the segments, like, if these were Masters of Horror episodes, they could easily have been stretched to an hour long. But I think trying to sort of, at least this one in particular, like, it's definitely an enjoyable segment. But I think that at the end of the day, there's definitely some areas, like, they could have just, if the segment was given a little bit more of a running time, maybe 20 minutes, I think some areas probably, at least in terms of the story, could have been expanded upon just a little bit more. But that's just me.
Yeah. No, I get you. I think the last thing I'll say about it, just really quick, is that I think part of what works for me with it is that I sort of view horror anthologies as kind of like a banquet, right? Mm. So, like, you know, and it's why, like, for example, I really love Creepshow, because that does something similar, where it starts you off with just this really fun, goofy, kind of nonsensical story with, you know, the Father's Day and the, you know, where's my cake? And that whole thing. Obviously, it's a better story than this. There's much more depth to it. But it's still ultimately just, I think it's the shortest in that film, just kind of like a nice little punch, make you laugh, that kind of thing. And it just sets the tone for the rest of the movie. And so this, I feel like, it could be expanded upon. It could have had more depth, but ultimately it sort of works kind of like an appetizer, you know, of just like, here's this short, fun little thing to kind of get you revved up and like excited for a goofy movie. And then that's when we start getting, you know, gradually kind of deeper and darker sort of story. So
yeah, without a doubt, the perfect way to start off this film by, as you said, doing something a little bit more fun, and then as the stories progress, they become a bit more darker and a little bit more crazier.
Right.
Although I want to add, like, okay, so I definitely have arachnophobia. I don't like spiders. You can hear all about how much I freak out over spiders. And I'm just, like, self-promoting us on our own show. But I'm just saying, if you go and listen to the 10 Things I Hate About You commentary, yes, there's a massive spider freak out in that episode. Anyway, I don't like spiders. The fact that this has, like, alien spiders, I should have been really freaked out. But they kind of looked way too cartoony CGI to really
they're CG
scary. And you know what, like, I didn't flinch, and that was a little bit disappointing. It should have been a lot more, like, terrifying.
It's funny because the practical effects in the film are very good, and the CG in the film is the opposite of that.
Yeah.
Although I did like the almost Evil Dead inspired, like, point of view of the spiders with the legs over the camera lens. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, that was really fun.
All right, I guess that can be an end of the discussion on The Thing in the Woods. Matt, what rating out of 5 do you give this segment?
It might seem like I'm being too generous here, but I'm going to say 3.5 out of 5. just because the reason being, I do think it has a lot of flaws, but as just a opening segment in an anthology, it's really fun. It sets the right tone, kind of hits a little bit of everything that I sort of love about the genre. So as an experience, I think 3.5 is okay.
And Marcy, what about yourself?
I'll give it 2.5. I'm not scared of these CGI spiders out of 5. So middle of the road. I think that's pretty fair.
I would give it about at least a 3 out of 5. Like, it's an enjoyable segment, and it's a perfect way to start off a film like Nightmare Cinema. But like I said, there's definitely, if it was a little bit longer, I feel like some of the problems I had with it would have been better. But anyways, we'll move right along to our second segment from the film, which is Mamari, which was directed by Joe Dante. And as we all know, Joe Dante is, of course, the director behind films such as Piranha, The Howling, and The Gremlins.
Woo! The Howling!
And of course, the Masters of Horror segments are Homecoming and The Screwfly Solution. And the episode was written by Richard Christian Matheson, and who of course wrote the Masters of Horror episode Dance of the Dead, and as well as The Damned Thing. This segment stars Richard Chamberlain, Zara Mahler, Mark Grossman, and Belinda Belaski. And the plot summary for this one is, a woman with facial scars seeks plastic surgery at a sinister clinic. Matt, what are your thoughts on Memari?
Listen, I'm a huge fan of Joe Dante. He made my favorite werewolf film ever, The Howling. I love his style. And it comes through in Memari. Marari. I don't even know why it's called that. but I got to be honest. I mean, this one's very just kind of meh to me. Like, it's first of all, I feel like in anthology where most of the shorts are pretty either twisty or subvert a lot of genre conventions, I feel like this one plays it pretty straight. You know, it's not, you can pretty much see everything coming from a mile away. I feel like I've seen this short 1,000 times before, you know, and it also kind of has, I think, that issue that we were talking about with, you know, why is this person being punished kind of thing? Because when I look at this, it's really not, unless the message is like, don't let men tell you what to do, which even then, I don't think she should be punished necessarily. She is being forced into all this basically by the men in her life, you know, like she just goes in to get the scar removed because her boyfriend pushes her to it. And then once she gets there, you know, the doctor's like, all right, so we're going to move your nose here, insert a cheekbone there, fluff up your ass here, you know, like, and she gives into all that, which, you know, so you can say, okay, it's a vanity tale, and maybe that's sort of why she has it coming. But I don't know. Ultimately, it just feels a little like blah. It's kind of fun and quirky, so I like that about it. It does have that kind of Joe Dante flair. I believe Richard Band did the score for it, which makes total sense when you think about it, because a lot of this film does kind of feel a little bit like a Full Moon quality movie, maybe from, you know, the 90s, early 2000s. And I don't know, it gets a laugh out of me, I guess. But to me, it's not really much of an adventure, if that makes sense. You know, just very kind of meh.
And Marcy, what did you think of Memari?
Yeah, I have no idea what to think of this still, to be honest. so as far as, like, you can see, it's got the Joe Dante style. There's a lot of quirk to it. I think that stuff works in its favor. But again, I don't know what the point of it was, especially with how it kind of twists with this ending. But as it starts, like, you do see a character with, like, a facial scar, and, you know, she... I don't know if it's like she's embarrassed or does it is, you know, she it's given her
probably embarrassed.
It's given her internal scarring. And, you know, we're in an age where acceptance is everything. People are going to look different. We have scars. This isn't, you know, Photoshop Central anymore. You know, people just want to be seen for who they are. And I feel like this film, the way he's like, oh, yeah, you're fine. But then suddenly, oh, I can get you this surgery. And I'm like, this has so many mixed messages. I don't know if I like it.
The thing that I will say about it, though, is I do think the intent of it is right, because when you watching this again, you know, I kind of noticed that there is a really heavy emphasis on kind of the way that, like, men objectify women in this, you know, and that's really, I think that's ultimately what it's kind of speaking out against, because you have this boyfriend and the male doctor that are kind of in charge of sort of like pushing her towards all these different surgeries. And then the thing that I found really interesting is when you look around the offices itself, where all this is being done, typically if you were to go to one of these surgical beauty plastic surgery places, you would see lots of portraits of women looking amazing and beautiful, and they've never looked better or whatever, you know. And when you look at the portraits in these offices, it's always the same one where it's a nude woman, but her back is turned to you, so you can't see her face. And I sort of took that as like sort of implying the belief that these men have that, you know, basically like women are kind of made to be made into the image that you want, you know.
Yeah.
And so it's not really about her, and it's kind of about, you know, sort of the horror that they bring on to her in making her feel like she has to look a certain way. And then I think that's just part of the joke at the end, if you want to call it that, is that, you know, when it's revealed that she looks absolutely hideous and is now kind of matching the look of his mother, which that's a whole other issue about this guy having mommy issues and basically wanting to fuck his mom. You know, I think all of that's just implying of, like, you know, this world that is driving women to look artificial. And yeah, like Marcy said, I don't really know if that quite fits anymore. You know, I would argue that it still does in some degree, because there are still plenty of there's still plenty of that bullshit out there, but
and I think, look, people's own body or self, not necessarily, but like self-image issues is definitely, it does get brought on a lot by social media and blah, 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 blah. And there definitely could have been, you know, something in there with this a little bit. But look, I think the moral...
Do you feel like maybe she needed more of a reason?
Yeah.
I guess.
I think she needed to kind of see, like, maybe if she had some backlash and she wasn't fighting up against it or something, you know. But then it kind of, like, yeah, the moral kind of is maybe, like, you don't need to change for anybody. But, you know, with all the stuff you've said, like, with the sort of men making women do things, but then ultimately it feels like almost the mum is the reason he's doing it. So not really, but kind of. And, yeah, I don't
know. The mom is, but I think the way again, you know, this stuff is never perfect. Like, you know, these readings never quite 100% line up. But I think the thing there is that perhaps his dad kind of drove his mom or forced her into it or whatever. And, you know, or she was influenced by some other force. So I think the idea is still that she herself was kind of influenced into doing all of that. And then it's just this weird kind of mommy's boy thing where he wants, you know, a woman that's just like his mom in every sense of the word. So I do think it still kind of falls at his feet. I see what you're saying, though. Like, again, this is another issue of a script not being totally fleshed out, because I think that some of this, as you mentioned, doesn't quite work as well, because we really don't, we need to empathize with her further than just having the scar.
Yeah.
You know, that's enough for like a base simplification where you can kind of, you know, you can understand why she would want to change, but there's no, like, you know, there's no reason. We're not seeing her really struggle, you know, before any of this. So it kind of feels like, what are you doing? Why are you letting them do all these things to you, you know?
Yeah, see, I think this could have worked as, say, like a Masters of Horror 1 hour episode, because it could have delved into some of this stuff a bit more. But Bede, you are quite quiet, so let's hear from you.
Well, I just didn't want to interrupt, but
I'm glad to be, thank you.
Yes. Yeah, I'm kind of liking, I thought this was an okay segment. Like, it definitely feels dated. I mean, is there any more we can really say about plastic surgery that hasn't been satirized already before? But I will give this segment credit, is that the twist behind it, where you think, oh, they're going to, you know, do plastic surgery on her to make her beautiful, but in the end, it's actually making her deliberately look much uglier, which in the eyes of everyone, her fiance, her mother, and also the doctor, they see as perfection and beautiful. And there is kind of a weird messaging there as well, which I like I said, I do give credit for going in that direction. But when you sort of kind of think about it, it is kind of a weird message to have. Especially what I did like, though, is at the start of the episode, like when we sort of see these two characters have dinner and she's sort of like worried about everyone around her seeing this big scar on her face. But her boyfriend is telling her, like, oh, no, you know, you look beautiful. I love you the way you are. Then, of course, he sort of slowly brings in the idea, but if you want plastic surgery, which is something I could definitely see happening in real life, kind of making, like, you have someone who is kind of, instead of like saying, oh, you should go get plastic surgery, kind of give that other person an idea to possibly want to do it.
Yeah, it's called manipulation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But then, of course, you know, it goes into that. And yeah, it's kind of, again, like the thing in the woods. Like, this one could easily have been expanded upon, because it does feel like it rushes through its story, even though the twist on its own does work. But it does sort of, again, you know, sort of have a bit of a mixed message behind it. I mean, I like the fact that even if she does look, basically the surgery makes her look like a monster, her fiance thinks she's beautiful. I guess that's a good message. I guess
it really is. And why did her surgery involve making her look like Voldemort? I could understand if she looked more like, you know, they sort of really overdid everything and blah, blah, blah. But then, like, they've, like, refigured her mouth and taken her nose. I'm like, this is just really stupid. I don't know.
I like how you're like, why did they make her look like Voldemort? There's no questioning on why did she get a Total Recall third tit?
Yes, there was also that. I forgot. I'm like, wait. I think I actually had messaged Bede when I was watching it going, why has she got three boobs?
The dream, I guess.
See, the fiance saw Total Recall. It's like, you know what would make our relationship better, Doc? Having a third boob.
Right.
Yeah, that one was just like, what?
But that being said, I did enjoy Richard Chamberlain as the Doctor. I thought he was a lot of fun in the role. And you could definitely tell he knew exactly what type of segment this was. And he was just playing it up. And it's hard for me to believe that Richard Chamberlain's in his 80s, but he feels...
I know, right?
He gives off the vibe of someone who feels a lot younger. But anyways...
could only hope to have his energy at that age.
Exactly. But I did think... Joe Dante did bring a little bit of his style and also his satirical tone to this episode. So,
I was going to say, it also feels a little bit like a Brian Yuzna short as well.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it reminds me so much of like The Dentist, you know, and like when she takes the mask off and sees herself for the first time, it just reminds me of that moment in The Dentist where the girl turns around to the camera and all of her teeth are missing. I don't know. It just felt like a lot like his work, too.
Yes. But yeah, I think overall, like, it's an okay segment. But yeah, this is another one where I feel like it needed to be longer and kind of work out some of the kind of the themes and messages that it was going for. And for the most part, it's an okay satire on the plastic surgery industry, but it could have gone a little bit further with it. And like I said, it does at least in the last few years, feels a little bit more dated. This would have made more sense if it was if this short was made in the 90s or 2000s. But I think, like I said, we've covered so much, so many films and TV shows have covered plastic surgery in satirical ways. It just doesn't really sort of provide anything too new outside of the twist that it has. But Matt, what rating do you give Mamari?
I think with this one, I'd probably go about 2.5 because it's not terrible. It's just not very inventive or anything like that. Like, it's still well made, but like you've been saying, it really doesn't do anything new or interesting, you know? So it's just kind of one that I have fun with it, but that's about it. So yeah, probably middle of the road, about 2.5.
And Marcy.
Yeah, I give it 2.5. I don't want to go to that doctor's surgery. Out of 5. It's kind of, it's just middle of the road kind of thing. Like, there's enjoyable bits, there's bits that I didn't get at all, there's bits that just were like, what? But yeah, that's my rating for this one.
Indeed. I give it about 2.5. Like I said, there's definitely interesting elements to it. Like, I did like the usage of the twist, and I think some of the performances are pretty solid. But yeah, like I said, it doesn't really provide anything too new, and it just needed to be a lot longer than it needed to be. But we'll move right along to the third segment from Nightmare Cinema, which of course is, and I'm trying my best not to giggle at this title, which is Mashit. Yes, I think it's meant to be Mashit, but it just says Mashit. Yes, this segment was directed by Ryohei Kitamura, who is the director behind films such as Versus, Godzilla Final Wars, and The Midnight Meat Train. And it was written, and I'm probably going to butcher her name, so please forgive me, Sandra Vercurill. If I butchered your last name, please forgive me. This segment stars Maurice Bernard, Stephanie Coode, Calista Bess, and Marila Garriga. Again, if I butchered any names, forgive me. and the plot summary, Catholic schoolgirls become possessed by a sex-crazed demon. Now, Matt, tell us your thoughts on the craziness that is Mashit.
Okay, so if The Thing in the Woods was not my favorite, then this one would easily be. I just think that this has arguably the most style in the film. And you know, a case can be made for the next segment, This Way to Egress, but I really love the style of it. You know, it plays like a homage to all of our great kind of Italian horror directors like Fulci, Roberto Bava, Argento. Like, all of them feel like they're a little bit mixed into this. I love the, you know, the bright red neon of it, and like the score from Aldo Shalaku, which kind of sounds a little, you know, it's got like goblin vibes to it a little bit. And Kitamura as a director, I love their style as well. Like Versus, one of their earlier films was, you know, a blast. And this feels a lot like that, where it's just kind of a lot of ridiculous over the top violence and completely senseless, but a lot of fun. So it's really, you know, so it's very entertaining. Again, it's another one where there's like no story whatsoever, really. You know, it's just kind of a lot of shit happening. But it's more forgivable for this, I think, because if you're going in that, you know, direction of just kind of sort of surreal, over the top Italian horror cinema, arguably most of those don't really have much of a plot. It's kind of about the vibe that it gives you. So in that sense, I think it succeeds really well. And then underneath, I mean, there's definitely a lot of interesting commentary, I think, you know, because it's another one of those stories where, so if you look at it as the priest is the one to come into the cinema and it's kind of his judgment, I guess. Again, it's one of those where if you look at it through their eyes, they think they're the good guy. But then you could also sort of argue, well, is this a commentary, though, on the church and how it kind of, you know, abuses and takes advantage of women and young children, because there's something just very on the nose about an ending with a priest just chopping the shit out of a bunch of little girls, you know. So I think from that point of view, you know, it's just this very kind of on the nose, I think, commentary on, like, yeah, the church just full of some not great people.
Yeah.
But no, I think it's really fun. I really enjoy this segment. It's perfectly fit in the middle where it is. To kind of rev that energy back up.
Yeah.
And Marcy, what did you think of my shit?
This segment, which I'm not going to say the name because no. I actually really enjoyed this one. I don't know why. It was just ridiculous. It was just went in all these weird directions, and, you know, you've got the Catholic Church, you've got the fucking idiot priest guy who bangs the nun, and then there's all these weird demonic like possessions, and then this kind of demonic thing is actually like a Jewish
after I watched this segment, because I was like thinking, I mean, is, because there's so many different demons like in different that we all know, like Pazuzu and stuff like that, so I was like, is Bashir actually like a demon from any of the holy texts, like the Bible or the Torah and that? So I went had a bit of research, and I discovered that Mashiach is more from the Jewish Bible, and Mashiach is technically not the name of it. It's more of a destroying angel. And I'm just reading this from Wikipedia. In the destroying angel, also known as Mashiach, but there's two H's in there, so it's Mashiach, is an entity sent out by the YHWH on several occasions to kill enemies of the Hebrews. And also it can be known as the messenger of death. So it's not actually pretty much, it's a different kind of like, so I guess this is kind of more of a demon they sort of more created for the story than anything else.
Possibly. Yes. But you could look at it, if it says it's, you know, enemies of Jewish people, well,
oh, that is true. Yeah, I guess I see what
church that's invaded by this demon, like, that could say all sorts of things.
Well, that is true.
It opens up all sorts of possibilities.
Yes.
But yeah, just looking at that, it's like, what are you trying to say exactly? Because you've specifically chosen something that is not, I guess, Catholic in terms of that. But it's kind of like a thing about this priest on this bizarre journey where he possibly has done very horrible things. We don't, you know, it's implied. But yeah, when you look too much into it, it kind of unravels a little bit. But just as a sort of like possession, what the hell's going on kind of thing, like, I felt like it worked in that way. And, you know, I didn't mind this one. So, yeah.
Yeah, I guess for me, the first time I watched this segment, I have to admit I was pretty disappointed in it, mainly because in the lead up before I saw this film, I kept hearing from a lot of reviews and a lot of people saying this segment was like the best one because it's absolutely insane. And I'm actually enjoy a lot of Ryohei Kitamura's films. Love, you know, versus Godzilla Final Wars and Midnight Meat Train, and even one of his previous films that he made in the last few years, No One Lives. Like, they're all insane little movies. And I thought, I can't wait to see what he would do with this one. And of course, you know, I like my religious horror as well.
Mm.
At the time, I felt like it wasn't as insane as I thought it was going to be. I felt like it felt a bit tame to, like, what I thought it was going to be. But now re-watching it again in prep for this podcast, I definitely have enjoyed it a lot more. And I think a lot of the reasons for that is like you said, Matt, this is definitely a love letter to Italian horror cinema,
mm-hmm.
from both the visual style, the score, the Goblin-esque score, and I think the performances are really done. But this is a case where I feel like Kitamura definitely brings his style to this story, where even if you kind of think about the plot and also a lot of the aspects of it, like I said, like the previous two segments, it doesn't dive into them as much as they could have, even though this is one of the more longer segments from the whole film. And you could easily have built up, actually, out of all of them, you could easily have made this whole segment into a feature-length film. Like, there's a lot of ground you can easily cover. And I do like the fact that basically, you know, it starts off with these kids being possessed, and they're one commits suicide, and you're not sure exactly what's going on, and it gets a little crazier from there, because you see the priest, played by Maurice Bernard, and one of the nuns, and I have to admit, one of the nun and also the psychiatrist, who also works at the church, it took me a while to figure out that it was two completely different actresses, because I thought they were the same actor, because they looked so similar.
Oh, God.
Oops. And I'm thinking, like, but she was with the kid before without, you know, her habit, and now she's having sex with the priest. What is going on? They're two different characters. My apologies. And of course, you know, like, it's you know, the priest and the nun having this, you know, very sexual affair, and then of course from that it unleashes this demon that goes around possess all the kids, and the priest, like, the nun try to figure out how to stop it, and then they think it's this one kid who's possessed, but before they do anything, they realize it's actually the psychiatrist who's now possessed is the one who's doing all the possessing, and then it gets crazier from there, and then you get this really sort of insane scene where both the priest and the nun have to fight off all these demonic kids, and there's blood and guts and limbs flying everywhere.
Yep.
So it's a lot of fun, but I feel like that's where the film more delivers, as being this kind of crazy 20-minute little segment with over-the-top gore and at being a love letter to Italian cinema. But I think, at least on a thematic level, I don't think it quite succeeds. Like, yeah, you could easily see it as being a commentary on the church, especially with the priest being this obviously corrupt figure who could just do whatever he wants until, you know, he gets his comeuppance from the demon. But I don't feel like the movie's really as concerned with that as much, and it's more about delivering a good time, I guess.
Well, I definitely agree it's more concerned about delivering a good time, which in this case, thank God, because the more I think about it, you know, this is actually a pretty dark story underneath all the fun, because, you know, like, the synopsis itself says it's about a sex demon or something, right? So I think that the implications here are that the priest has been doing some pretty awful priest things that we can all probably, you know, picture. And you know, so it's not just the nun that he's fucking. Like, it kind of implies that he's been a little handsy with these kids, and from there you can sort of take it as, okay, well, that's what this possession is. You know, they're all kind of, it's like all their trauma, you know, kind of coming out and, you know, sort of like monstrous and possessed and all that kind of stuff. And it is ultimately about him getting his comeuppance, which is why I really like that. You know, his death is pretty much being penetrated by a giant, you know, staff or whatever it is, which I feel is pretty intentional there. So I think thematically this one actually works for me, but it does do a lot to avoid the subject dead on, I think, because it wants to, you know, it probably wants to have a little more fun than really get into the awfulness of what's happening here.
Yeah.
Like, but it is confusing too. There's a lot going on, and that's why I said, you know, as a tribute to Italian horror, I think it gets dismissed because we don't expect it to make sense, but it does. But in fairness, it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think, like you say about it, I think as being a homage to Italian horror cinema, I think it works more in that regard, because like if you look at a lot of Italian horror films that kind of delve into really dark subject matter, they sort of touch upon it, but they still, you know, bring out more of the gore and the gruesomeness more than anything else, while still, yeah, like still touching on those themes without diving into them too much. But like I said, I think this is a segment that I think would have actually would benefit from being a longer film. I would love to see a whole film that kind of has like demon children just like trying to kill everybody.
I think that would actually work. Like this could have been a Masters of Horror episode.
Oh yeah, totally.
Yeah, definitely. But,
Matt, what is your rating for Machete?
I think it'd be unfair to not give this a 3.5 as well, since I gave that to Thing in the Woods. Because again, I think it accomplishes everything it's out to do. You know, it's far from perfect. It definitely kind of leaves you a little bit confused, maybe. But I think setting out to be the tribute that it is, I think it nails it. I think it gets everything right in what it's trying to accomplish. It just ultimately comes down to, I think, a matter of whether you like that from it. So
and Marcy, what did you think of Mash? I've got to say the title properly, because I know they don't actually say Mashit, they say Mashet, I think it is. But yeah, what did you think of this segment?
Yeah, like I said, I enjoyed it for what it was. I give it a 3 priests bagging a nun out of 5. Pretty solid middle segment, I'd say. Yeah.
I give this one 3.5 as well. And now that I sort of think about it, this segment is probably the perfect one to have in the middle, because it does have that sort of fun vibe of the first two segments. But then it kind of also tackles sort of darker subject matter, which the next two segments we're going to be talking about shortly kind of dive into more than, say, being fun ones. But overall, I enjoyed this one. It's a fun homage to Italian horror cinema without, I guess, being too overtly a homage. Like, it captures the vibe of it pretty well. And, you know, it's got some gruesome gore, some interesting little themes here and there. And I thought the performances were solid, although I have to find some of the green screen to be questionably bad in certain scenes.
Yes, I did not mention that. The rooftop green screen is pretty awful.
That is almost the room level bad, that green screen. Yeah. Actually, no, the room actually has better than this one. But I digress. Speaking of digress, let's go this way to egress. See what I did there?
I don't know. Was that clever or just really lame?
Maybe it's late. But anyway.
Maybe both.
Yes, exactly. But this way, we'll talk about the fourth segment, which is This Way to Egress, which was directed by David Slade, who, of course, is the director behind films such as Hard Candy, 30 Days of Night, and as well as episodes of Hannibal. The screenplay was written by David Slade and Lawrence C. Connolly, which is actually based on a short story called The Traumatic Descent by Lawrence C. Connolly. And this segment stars Elizabeth Reeser, Adam Godley, Ezra Buddington, Bronwyn Merrill, and in a voice cameo, Patrick Wilson. And the plot summary for this one is, a woman waiting for a doctor's appointment experiences disturbing shifts in reality. Now, Matt, tell us your thoughts on This Way to Egress.
So this is one where it's very interesting. You know, it kind of plays a little bit like a combination of Lynch and Cronenberg. You know, I get a little bit of vibe from both of them. Like, you know, it feels a lot like Eraserhead, but then there's also in just like the kind of the look and style of it. But then the script feels very, you know, Cronenbergian to me. But it's a fascinating one, because, you know, I think we're dealing with a woman. You can read all sorts of different things into this, but the one I lean most towards is perhaps a woman that's kind of had sort of a midlife crisis. And, you know, I get the feeling that she has maybe murdered her husband and probably her kids and is living with the guilt of that, perhaps. And then, you know, the style of it's unique. I like the choice for the black and white, because it kind of implies that like all the color has been drained out of her life. You know, there's no joy or anything in it anymore. It's just this gray. And so I think it's an intriguing kind of study of like mental health and that sort of stuff, but it's just not a personally my kind of thing. You know, I'm not personally a huge Lynch fan. And this seems to heavily. Oh yeah, I know. Everybody's probably doing it right now. I like some Lynch, but I'm hit or miss with him. But so it's not particularly my jam. And it's another one of those where, you know, it's so complex that it feels like a little too complicated for this kind of movie, if that makes any sense.
Marcy, tell us your thoughts on This Way to Egress.
Yes, well, for anybody wondering, I was giving Matthew, I'm calling him Matthew because he's naughty, the thumbs down. But you know what? Matthew is allowed his own opinions and feelings, and I respect that.
No, he doesn't.
Fine. No, he's allowed to. I can just get it out of my system and be like, yeah, that's cool. It just means it makes me more unique for loving David Lynch. But
yes.
Anyway.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. This felt like a David Lynch, could David Cronenberg, like combined. So naturally, that's like totally for me. So I think maybe this was one that I really, really liked. But at the same time, it felt so out of place in this. This would have like really been a great Masters of Horror episode. And I do like David Slade, the stuff that I've seen that he's done, really, really like it. Yeah, this was definitely more like my jam. It very much is something about mental health, and you can kind of see like maybe what the themes and things would be. But yeah, it does definitely deals a lot with like guilt, and the visual manifestations definitely indicate that. So I think, yeah, it is a little bit on the nose, maybe still confusing messages or whichever. But yeah, I felt like this should have been in a completely different like anthology of let's study different ways of like the human mental conditions and da 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 da. You could put this next to say the amusement park, you know, as a PSA, seriously, for two different things that are kind of linked. But
confusing was the wrong word. I think I mean it's like you said, it doesn't fit the rest of the film. It's the only one of the segments that I feel takes its subject very seriously and is kind of giving you like this hard hitting, you know, sort of like depressing kind of short. And, you know, the rest are all just kind of bonkers insanity and really goofy.
Yeah.
This is the only one that's kind of like, no, I'm going to fuck you up and really make you think about, you know, this existential crisis and stuff like that. So
yeah, definitely. It is completely like out of place for the tone of everything else. Like I get you're sort of putting in different things, da da da, but when you do have like a horror anthology as a film, I think your segments need to, yeah, they can be different and da 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 da, but there needs to be something that links them that is similar, so it doesn't all the way feel too different. And I think, you know, you mentioned Creepshow. Creepshow is a great example of how that actually works with, you know, how, yeah, they're all very different, but there's this tone and kind of structure and da 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 da. I keep doing that, but it works as a whole piece. The segments feel way kind of disjointed. And I think that was kind of an issue with, and again, I'm bringing it up, Quicksilver Highway. It was two segments, but they kind of didn't feel like they were part of the same thing. Whereas Creepshow, it does. So this does feel very different, but it might be the one that I actually think was the best of the bunch.
Well, I got to agree what you say, because it does feel out of tone with the rest of the segments, because some obvious reasons and some not so obvious reasons, being that this is more of a sort of a psychological horror film about this woman's descent into madness, and being it's also shot in black and white as well. But I guess in a way, like when we're talking about like how, at least with something like Creepshow, at least there's sort of like a thematic kind of through line through all those segments. And I think with Nightmare Cinema overall is that like Masters of Horror and, you know, to an extent, Fear Itself, McGarris's whole idea is that pretty much get these filmmakers together and let them create whatever they want, really, regardless whether they're linked together or not. So that's why I guess if this was like episodes stretched out over a few weeks, like standalone episodes of, say, a third season of Masters of Horror, that would kind of make sense. But having them all together in a film like this, I could definitely see that tonally it feels all over the place, and maybe there's no kind of through line with all of them. But at the same time, though, it kind of worked for me, too, because This Way to Egress, I have to say, is probably my favorite segment from the whole film. Because I do like David Slade as a filmmaker. I think he's has a very interesting eye to all of his work. And whether he's working on films or TV, he has a very unique, auteurish style to every project he brings. And I would say out of all the segments to this entire film, this is the one that feels very distinctly like his work. Like, you could watch this segment and think, oh, David Slade directed this segment, because a lot of the kind of visual style and flourishes that he has been using since Hard Candy is very prevalent in this film. And also, he, compared to everyone else on the other segments, because some segments have similar cinematographers or composers and editors, he brought his own crew onto this one, including the cinematographer Joe Willems, who has shot pretty much outside of Twilight Eclipse, has been the cinematographer on a lot of his projects. So he's got this working with the same crew as he usually works on this one, hence why it feels like a David Slade film. But on its own, though, I think it's a really interesting, beautiful little psychological horror film. And I think Elizabeth Reeser is fantastic in this segment. And I definitely get both the vibes of David Lynch and David Cronenberg throughout this whole segment. Particularly with that weird looking gun that Elizabeth Reese's character has at one point, which starts pulsing like something out of Videodrome.
Oh, yeah.
It made me wonder what it was. Like, is it because it kind of looks like lipstick coming out the end of it at one point?
Yeah.
You know, I was wondering, is she like imagining her lipstick as a gun, or what's happening here?
That could have been it, but she might have also gotten it off Tracy Lords from the Tommyknockers, because she had like a laser lipstick.
Yes. And I do like the slow descent as it goes along, because it sort of starts off subtly, because she's in this like big sort of waiting room with her two annoying kids, who are possibly may or may not be there at all. And then, of course, as she's sort of hanging out with this nurse, she starts to notice weird things. Like, one of my favorite effective moments is she's looking at one of her eyes, and one of her eyes has kind of gone upside down. Which is very unsettling and unnerving. And it's just carries on from there. And like, you see all these like people with misshaped faces and almost monstrous look to them, which is definitely a combination of practical effects and CGI as well. I know this one was a very personal story to David Slade, because he had been wanting to make this short story into a film even way before Hard Candy, and had plans to do a feature film version of this.
And actually
has the script, but I think the writer of that script, who was a good friend of his, passed away before they even made it. So he kind of made the short as, but this was a short he still wanted to do. So he decided, since it was a short story, he'll make it as a segment for this film. So I guess this was, you know, in a way, like Mick Garris letting these filmmakers do the types of stories they want to make. And being that this is, out of all the segments, out of one of only two filmmakers that had, where the filmmaker actually wrote the story themselves. So this is definitely a very personal film for him, and you kind of get that feeling while watching it. Like, there's definitely a lot of questions, like, what is this short trying to say, and what is this, whether it be on a thematic level, but also on a symbolic level with the visuals. Like, you could definitely say, like, this woman is, like, these people are trying to help her, but she is too far into her madness that she just can't be helped anymore. And her bit, and we'll get to her little bit in the cinema when we get to the wraparound segment. And I would say her final little scene in the cinema is probably the most tragic out of all of them. But yeah, I overall really enjoyed this segment, and to me, it's one of the best ones. But Matt, what are your final thoughts on, and also rating for, This Way to Aggress?
Yeah, no, final thoughts. I really like everything you all have said about it. And I didn't know that it was something that he'd been wanting to do forever. So that's actually pretty cool that makers, you know, allow him to do this. But I think final thoughts again is, I don't know, probably about a 3.5 for me again, because I think it's very well made. It's just not, they're just, I don't know. It just doesn't, it's another one of those where I just feel like I want more, you know, it just feels like there's more there. So I mean, this is a tough one. It's a tough one, I'll be honest, but I'm going to give it a 3.5 because I do think that on a technical level, it's very well made. I do think you get the best performances out of it, you know? So, I mean, really a lot of what's working against it for me is just its place in the anthology itself, you know, and just kind of feeling like it misses the assignment just a little bit.
I guess you could say, like, going from MASH hit to this, it's almost like watching The Raid and then getting the Seventh Seal right afterwards.
Yeah. It's a bit of a whirlwind.
Or even like Grindhouse, like going from Planet Terror to Death.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Because it's very different. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Like, I guess in a way, because I do remember because I was listening to Mick Garris's podcast, Postmortem, and I think there was a reason why they put these particular films in the order that they did, but I can't remember what it was, but I'll have to go back to one of those previous episodes to find out. But yeah, maybe this is one where, like, it should have been maybe earlier in the episode, but they saved it for later because maybe they felt this is one of the better ones and more interesting ones to kind of show in the film. But
yeah,
but enough about me. Marcy, what did you think of this segment?
Well, yeah, I give this one 3.5. I don't like these nurses at this place at all. Out of 5, I think probably for me the strongest segment. I really enjoyed it. It's definitely worth watching, even if you're not particularly interested in maybe watching the whole thing, or if you are, yeah, look out for this one. And Bede, what about you?
I give this one 4 out of 5. I really enjoyed it that much. I think, again, like, it's a really interesting, thought-provoking segment. It's visually very beautiful, and it has a very great, like, it's well-directed by David Slade, who brings a lot of style to it, and it's effective as a sort of look at a mind descending into madness, and I thought Elizabeth Risa did such a great job with her performance. So, yeah, that's overall my thoughts on it, but we'll get to the fifth and final segment of this film, which is Dead, which was written and directed by the film's creator, Mick Garris, and it stars, and I'm probably going to butcher this actor's name, so please forgive me, Faili Rakotohaven. If I butchered his name, please forgive me. Also starring Annabeth Gish, Daryl C. Brown, Lexi Pantera, and Orson Chaplin. And the plot summary for this one is, an adolescent piano prodigy dies, is revived, and is under attack from supernatural forces. Matt, what are your thoughts on Dead?
You know, I hate to think about it this way, considering that Mick Garris put the film together, but it's personally my least favorite. It's another one that I kind of feel like, similar to Mirari, you know, I feel like this is one where I've kind of seen this before quite a few times. Mm. You know, I don't really feel like I'm seeing anything different here. And while it fits the tone of the film, I think that this one goes a little bit too hokey at times, you know, like why I feel that way is because it's a short that's meant to be taken more seriously. You know, it's not a comedy. It's not supposed to be over the top or really silly like some of the other ones, but there are moments that I think play out that way that kind of defeats or take a little bit away from the emotional impact of it. Like, you know, in the end, when the kid is being strangled and you've got these kind of hokey visions of his mom and then the other patient, you know, being like, come to the light. No, don't come to the light. And I know it's not what they say, but, you know, it's basically that sort of thing. And it just, and, you know, it kind of looks like the Lion King Simba thing. And like, it just really doesn't work or land for me. I know what Garris was trying to do here. And I do think that the theme of, you know, kind of like this sort of horrible commitment, almost the family, and this idea of, like, you know, the mom almost trying to get the kid killed so that he can be with her in heaven. Like that hits really hard, especially for me. Like, I have issues with my family, and so I can relate a lot to that. So that works, but it just, I don't know. I just never really felt the emotion of it. It's kind of a little too silly, I think, to work from the very beginning with the whole kid's, like, Batman origin story, basically.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I've never really liked this one. I feel like it's kind of a weak way to go out. So yeah, that's my thoughts on that.
Marcy, what did you think of Dead?
Yeah, I think I pretty much agree with Matt for the most part as well. It might be for me maybe the weakest or maybe less interesting, because we have kind of seen this several times. It's very, you know, the Sixth Sense type of thing in a way. And it sort of does add something else with, like, him seeing the mum and the mum being like, yes, you have to, like, die to be with me and stuff. That is kind of heartbreaking and sad, but I don't think it really addresses it in that way. I liked the actress who kind of plays the kid's friend in the hospital and then ends up sort of helping him later after she passes. Thought that was pretty good. I thought the lead, like, was really solid as well. It just, I don't know, something about the tone and maybe the length of the piece. I think this could have actually been a little bit shorter and maybe tighter to have told what it needed to tell, maybe a little bit better, because I think it does sort of get brought down because it drags on a little bit. But, like, overall, I think it was probably, yeah, maybe more middle of the ground. And I get what, like, Mick Garris was trying to go for, but, you know, that said, maybe if I, you know, well, it wasn't my favorite thing, I do give Mick Garris a lot of credit, and especially for, you know, our podcast in general, because it's because of him we have podcasts of horror. You know, he does bring a lot to the world of horror, whether you are a fan of his or not. But I think you need to be a fan of Mick Garris the person, because he just seems like the loveliest, the absolute loveliest person, and he brings a horror together. You know, if you don't think maybe he's the best writer or director or blah, 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 fair enough, but I think you could say Mick Garris the person, wonderful. But, you know, I do think he has some really solid and very good contributions with horror, and
Critters 2 is a staple for me.
Yeah, right. And just overall, like, I think this was okay. I get what he was, you know, get what he was doing and stuff, but at the same time, I'm very thankful for all the things that Mick Garris has given us. I think we need more, like, horror anthology films, and, you know, I give him credit that he's done the route with the TV and, you know, the films, and that there is a lot of room for more horror anthology. So yeah, Bede, over to you, buddy.
I think I might have liked this segment a little bit more than both of you. Like, I do agree it's nothing we haven't seen before, but I think what made this one work for me was the emotion of the piece. Like, in a way, you could, I could definitely see that this was another kind of personal kind of project to Mick Garris as well. Like, a lot of the emotions the main character Riley feels felt very personal to me as a viewer. But that being said, though, like, even though I did enjoy this segment, the stuff with the mum, like, she gets killed, then she wants Riley to come join him in the afterlife, but then she kind of goes and kills her friend, who also has the same kind of powers as Riley does, who, because she died for, like, a few minutes, came back, and she can see dead people as well. But the whole segment never dives into why is the mother this way. Like, it's never set up at all. Maybe if it was, like, it sort of sets up that the dad is, you know, a little bit absentee because he arrives pretty late for Riley's concert at the beginning. But outside of that, there isn't really that kind of hostility between the parents, or if there's, like, an obsessiveness or protectiveness from the mother when it comes to Riley. So when that kind of shifting character happens after she dies, it really doesn't make sense, especially when, you know, she legit murders someone who's trying to stop her from killing Riley so she can join her in the afterlife. It just doesn't really make any narrative or character sense. But outside of that, though, the rest of the story was, you know, pretty solid for me. I think Awesome Chaplin, who plays the carjacker who kills the parents at the beginning, I thought he was a very effective human villain in the piece. And I was surprised to find out that he's actually the grandson of Charlie Chaplin and the son of Ilkel Salkind, the producer of the Superman films.
Blowing my mind.
Yeah. And but I thought he was very effective here. And I thought the actor who played Riley, who, of course, being Fale Rakotovahavn, again, if I butchered his name, please forgive me, I thought he was great in the segment as well. Agreed. Like, I thought he brought a lot of emotion to the whole piece. But yeah, overall, I think it's a decent segment, even if we have seen this one many times before. And of course, there are definitely aspects of the plot I think it could have dived into, especially the whole aspect with the mum, which I still don't get.
Fair enough.
Yes. But, well, I guess we can do our final thoughts and rating for this segment. Mm-hmm. Matt, what is your final thoughts and rating for Dead?
So before I give my rating, I'll just really quickly kind of expand on what Marcy said earlier, is that despite it being my least favorite in the film, I do also really appreciate Mick Garris's work. And I think that, you know, and I do like him as a director. You know, he, like I kind of chimed in with before, he made some very influential films for me on a kid, such as Critters 2, which is my favorite in that franchise, and which I must have watched like 100 times as a kid. But I really love his contributions as a producer as well. You know, he is that voice in the horror community that always fights for directors to be able to get their visions onto screen. You know, he's always been about doing it your way and not really letting the studio get in the way. And that's what I really loved about Masters of Horror. And that's what I really like about this is that, you know, for any of their flaws, you can tell that the directors put what they wanted to on screen, you know, aside from any budget limitations. So so you feel like they're telling the stories they want to tell at the very least. And I love that. And it's what I think is attractive about Nightmare Cinema is that you do feel that, you know, you feel that passion going into all of these, whether you end up enjoying them or not. So, but with all that being said, yes, it is my least favorite. I would probably give it a 2 because I think the emotion's almost there. I think the main actor, I'm not going to try to repeat his name either, but I think the main actor is a great performance. I'm always really impressed when, you know, kid actors can really move me the way that he does. So I think that's effective. But again, tonally, it's kind of a little bit of a mess. You know, we're trying to be very emotional about it, but then a lot of these hokier moments, I think, kind of deflate that a bit. So yeah, it again, little weak of a way to go out, but but overall, it's not bad. Like it's still something I enjoy watching. It's just not as effective as the others.
Yeah.
And yourself, Marcy?
Yeah, I give this 2.5 bizarre kind of Batman origin stories out of 5. Yeah, I think it's very, it's middle of the road. It's solid. There's, you know, good aspects. There's not as good aspects. But yeah, it Mick Garris has given people opportunities to just do what they want, whether those things are good or bad, resonate with us, whichever. I think it's good to just do what you want. And, you know, maybe I didn't enjoy it as much as someone else did, but that's, you know, it's there. It's for entertainment. It's to say something. So, yeah, I mean, I still think it's fairly watchable and really good performances as well.
I give this about 3. Like I said, it's not anything too new, but I think the emotion and the performances of this segment really carried through. For me, it's a kind of sort of elevated a little bit more. And I'll say my thoughts on Mick Garris as a person, as a filmmaker at the end of this episode. But I think overall, it's a pretty decent segment. Again, this is one I believe from what I've read, he actually was wanted to do for an episode of Masters of Horror. But, you know, I digress there because that never happened. So it was good that he at least got to revisit this idea for this film instead. And like, it may not be the best segment to end this whole film on, but I still think it's a pretty, at least for me, a pretty decent one nonetheless. But before we wrap up on this whole film, we have to talk about the wraparound segment, which is called The Projectionist, which, of course, features a lot of some of the actors who have appeared in our segments we've talked about, and along with The Projectionist, played by the one and only Mickey Rourke. we probably won't give a rating for the wraparound segment because it's a wraparound segment. But Matt, what did you feel? I mean, how do you feel about the wraparound segment, The Projectionist?
I love the concept of it. I don't love the execution of it. I mean, first of all, I don't know what's going on with Mickey Rourke's look here, you know, he's clearly supposed to be some kind of, as he calls himself, a debt collector, a collector of souls, sinners, whatever you want to call him, right? Debt, people that have died, but he just looks so much like a reject biker in a 80s porn, or like, I don't know what's going on with the look of the character. I love the theater setup, you know, I like this idea of people kind of viewing their own death or their life on the film screen, you know, the cinematic screen, you know, it's always been representative to me of like dreams, not lived or to be lived. And so I think it works in this sense of, you know, death and kind of reliving your memories, so to speak. And so I like, I, I guess I'm gonna, as I really like the setup of it, but the execution's just weak. You know, I don't feel like the projectionist really has much of a presence. You know, like even Sam and Trick or Treat just kind of sitting around with his lollipop. You know, I feel like he kind of has more of an imposing presence on the scene than anything that Mickey Rourke ends up doing in this. I don't know. It just doesn't work for me. I'm gonna be honest. I like the idea, it just didn't work.
I should have stated before, the projectionist wraparound segment was written and directed by Mick Garris himself. I forgot to mention that earlier. But Marcy, yeah. What are your thoughts on the projectionist?
I think it's a solid wraparound. It's a really cool idea and concept. So I actually really liked that, sort of the people meeting in the cinema, being stuck there to see, you know, a very bizarre film unfold that kind of has something to do with them. I thought that was really, really good. I liked that there was a character of the projectionist. But I don't know what Mickey Rourke was doing. It's kind of brilliant and terrible all at the same time. And I think knowing that Matt Frewer was originally meant to play that role makes more sense to me, because I could see him doing something really like quirky and goofy, but that would still work for it. Mickey Rourke, I'm not too sure what he was doing, and I'm pretty sure they were just his own clothes. But yeah, I thought, you know, overall, it was pretty solid. It's a good way to kind of tie everything together.
I've kind of a mixed minds of the projectionist as a wraparound segment. I like both of you. I like the concept of it, with these characters coming into, they see like the sign, it has their name and the title of the segment there, and they're like, what the fuck is going on? And they go in, they see this short film, and then of course they get their final judgment. And the way they kind of present this, especially when after the short is finished, and we see what happens to these characters, they do feel like the intros and outros of an episode of a TV show. Like something happens to the characters, and then we're just going on to the next character walking into the cinema. Like, if you split this entire film into five parts, it could easily just be a TV show just based on those segments alone.
Totally.
And I do agree what we were saying earlier. Like, some of the ones where the people who are being judged don't make sense, like the first two don't make sense, since, you know, they're characters who didn't do anything bad in their segments and they're just being judged anyway. It doesn't make sense. And also you could say Elizabeth Risa, her character, well, her one is interesting because she's the one of the only ones in which the projectionist isn't involved. She just shoots herself at the end of her segment, hence why I said her demise in this, her wraparound, is the more tragic out of all of them. But then you got Riley being the last one, and Mickey Rourke's like, oh yeah, you can just go, you're an innocent one. But I'm like, what about some of the other characters who didn't do anything bad? What about them? Not unless we missed something, but
maybe we did, who knows?
Yeah, exactly. But I'm kind of like you, Marcy, in terms of Mickey Rourke's casting in this film. It's kind of brilliant, but also just bizarre at the same time, because like I did read up, like I was telling you before, like before we started the show, that Matt Frewer was Mick Garris's, he had in mind to play this character. And then one of the producers who knew Mickey Rourke personally and was a good friend said, how about Mickey Rourke as a projectionist instead? Because that would give a bit of clout to this film, having an Oscar nominated actor like him. And from what I understand, a lot of those clothes that Mickey Rourke wore in the film were actually his.
That makes sense. It does.
It makes a lot of sense.
And he shot all of his scenes for this film in one day, which again makes total sense. But also, like you say, Matt, like the projectionist as a character doesn't really have that much of a presence. Like, we don't actually see him in this film till almost an hour in. And that's just after the Mamari segment.
All right. And even then, I don't really know what Mickey's going for in terms of character. You know, he's like, is he supposed to be like sexy and dangerous or something? Because
I have no idea.
I don't know. The character doesn't feel like your kind of traditional horror host, which I'm not asking for him to be just like everything else, but it just doesn't, there wasn't enough personality there, I think, to really make the character work.
Matt Frewer, like, I could see him doing something very creepy and kind of weird with if he was in that role. But when I see Mickey Rourke in this film, he's just Mickey Rourke. I don't see him being like this creepy character, although he goes around like wearing a jacket and wearing no shirt underneath, showing off his chest like he's Craig Sheffer in Voyage of the Rock Aliens. but it's such a weird performance, and one where he's just Mickey Rourke playing himself. But at the same time, it's kind of what makes the wraparound interesting. And in a way, it kind of makes it at least memorable for me, like wherever I'm still debating whether it actually works or not. But overall, I mean, the wraparound, I guess, in concept works. I could definitely see it working more for a TV show as like an intro and outro type of thing. But I think how it's handled in the film, it's not quite as executed as it could have been. And I would have loved to have seen more Mickey Rourke just doing weird Mickey Rourke shit. And also his hair is weird in this film, but I know he's had that hairstyle for a while now. But overall, I think the segment is solid and enjoyable, but for not the reasons I don't think Mick Garris was going for. But I guess that could be a wrap on Nightmare Cinema. But we'll go around with our final thoughts on the film overall and then our rating, and then we can wrap up the show. Matt, your final thoughts on Nightmare Cinema overall?
Final thoughts overall is, you know, even though not every segment works, which is fine, you know, I always look at anthology films as kind of generally being a mixed bag where there's a little bit something for everybody and not everything's going to work for you. Even though not all of it works, I think it for the most part does. And the thing that I most appreciate about it, like I was saying before, is that it really feels like the filmmakers are let off the leash. They're allowed to kind of do whatever they want to, which is pretty apparent in the storytelling. You know, we get some pretty bonkers stuff here, and it works. It does. Mick Garris again has a talent, I think, for anthology horror storytelling, in that for the most part the film's laid out really well, like touching on that, you know, kind of feast of stories I was mentioning earlier. Like it does all the right things in there and kind of giving that really nice sort of appetizer with the thing in the woods, and then we get kind of weird with Mirari, and then, you know, Mashit like injects all this energy back into it, and then we get the creepier stuff later on. So I think it's really well balanced in that sense. And it also just, I remember when I watched this, the thing that I enjoyed the most was just that it's really fun, you know, and it feels like such a weird thing to say, but, you know, there's so much horror out there that, and this doesn't make it bad, but there's a lot of horror out there that's really getting like deep and dark into, you know, our personal traumas and stuff like that. And every once in a while, it's just nice to have a film like Nightmare Cinema that, well, it might have thematics that deal with a little bit of that. On the surface, it's just a really entertaining, good time. And I feel like we see less of that at the moment. So I just really enjoy that about it. Overall, I think it's a little bit above average for an anthology film. I've seen plenty of terrible anthology horror films over the years, and this one is better than most. It just, you know, just not every segment really lands like it should. So
yes. Marcy, what are your
overall
final?
Good.
What rating would you give it, Matt, like overall?
Yeah.
Oh, me. Yes. Well, I think since my average rating was about 2.5, I'll probably give it 3. You know, I think it's very effective for the most part, kind of average in other areas. You know, it's definitely restricted by the budget a little bit, which shows and takes some away from it. But overall, I think it's just a very solid film.
Yes. Marcy, what are your final thoughts and rating for Nightmare Cinema as a whole?
So, well, I give this one a 3. I don't know what Mickey Rourke is doing, out of 5. It's a pretty solid and entertaining and at times fun horror anthology. And as Matt said, you know, a lot of anthology, regardless of if it's horror or not, will probably end up being more sort of middle of the road, because there's going to be things for different people, different tastes. So not everything's always going to be to your own personal, you know, taste. But I still think it's a pretty fun and solid and worth a watch for sure. And once again, thank you for everything, Mick Garris. I've enjoyed this journey over 20 episodes of the things that you have had a hand in creating. Bede, over to you.
Indeed. Before I go into my final thoughts, I need to make a clarification. Luckily, I'm doing it in this episode rather than the next one. I did say earlier that David Slade and Mick Garris were like two of the only filmmakers who wrote or co-wrote their own segments. I was very wrong. Alejandro Bouguer did write his segment as well. So I completely apologize for that, and to you, sir. but overall for me, I agree with both of you. I give this about 3 out of 5 overall. Like, it, as all with a lot of anthology films, whether they're horror or not, it is that you're going to have ones that are going to be mixed bag. It's very rare that you have one where every segment is like amazing. But I think all the ones in this film are still pretty interesting and quite enjoyable in their own way. Of course, some are better than others, but I think overall, like having these wide variety of different segments in a film like this is what makes Nightmare Cinema such a memorable anthology film, because it does have that sort of Masters of Horror template of letting these filmmakers make the type of stories that they want to make, regardless of whether they are connected together or not. And I appreciate Mick Garris. And I mean, there's no more that I can already say that both of you haven't already said about Mick Garris. It's been quite a journey over these 20 episodes of Podcasters of Horror, going from Masters of Horror to Fear Itself and to finally this film, and to seeing like his love of horror and also getting these horror directors to make the films that they want to make through an anthology series or a film, and just showing his love for genre and being a champion for all things horror. And also, it has provided us some great things to talk about on this show, and one of the main reasons why we started this podcast in the first place. And I thank you, Mick Garris, for everything you've done for the horror genre, and we hope you continue to do that for the years to come. And also, and Nightmare Cinema, I would say I would love to see more. If they ever make a sequel or even a TV show version of Nightmare Cinema, I would be down to see more of this, the world.
It's been discussed, so hopefully.
Yeah. But they have to bring Mickey Rourke back just for every segment. I just want to see Mickey Rourke just again do Mickey Rourke things in in this sequel film or TV show, but I digress. But that could be a wrap on this 20th episode of Podcasters of Horror. Thank you, Marcy, for always being an awesome co-host as per usual.
You're welcome.
And Matt, thank you for coming on and ending this journey of Mick Garris's anthology work with us.
Yes, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be a part of the end of the journey here.
Indeed. Like, it won't be the end of the journey for this podcast, because we've hinted in previous episodes that once we were done with Mick Garris's anthology work, we will expand upon other anthology films by doing double features, and we have some pretty cool ones lined up in the future, and we'll also dive into other anthology TV shows as well, and particularly one we're going to do every 2 months, which we're going to dive in the 4 seasons of the, from what I hear, the very underrated horror anthology TV show Channel Zero. So
indeed. So look for that in the next episode.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. Again, thank you to all of our listeners for listening to this episode. We deeply appreciate it. Matt, where can people find you on the internet this week?
Yeah, so you can find me on my Twitter at Killer Critics. You can also find all of my writings and reviews at killerhorrorcritic.com, and follow my podcast, Killer Horror Critic, which you can find pretty much anywhere you get your podcasts. I do it with my wife, where we pretty much just get drunk and criticize horror films. It's usually pretty fun, but yeah, that's where you can find me.
And Marcy, where can people find you on the internet this week?
Yes, everybody check out Matt's stuff. It's all very awesome. And you can always check us at supermarcy.com. There you can find Podcasters of Horror on all your major podcast streaming platforms, and even the ones that aren't major, because we're everywhere. And you can find the Super Network on Twitter at twitter.com/sm_supernetwork. And you can find me at Super Marcy on Twitter as well. And if you want to check out the After Dark podcast network that I'm doing on Twitter at AfterDarkPodNet, so you can check that out as well. And yes, I'm on Letterboxd at Super_Marcy, so you can check out that as well. But yes, please check out supermarcy.com. Bede.
People want to find me personally, they can find me on my Twitter page at twitter.com/BedeJamine, or my Letterboxd account at letterboxd.com/BedeJamine. And you can also find all my work over at supermarcy.com with all my reviews and columns. Yep, that's the end of this episode of Podcasters of Horror. We hope all of our listeners enjoyed this episode, and we'll see you all again next month for our next journey of the show. We'll see you later, everybody. Bye.
Give me, bitch!
Super Network is proudly sponsored by Surfshark VPN.
Why would you have a VPN in this day and age? Well, a lot of people are quite concerned about tracking and their online privacy, and using a VPN ensures that you are safe and secure online. Surfshark VPN provides a lot of extra added layers of security, as well as ad blocker and a kill switch if your information is ever compromised.
A great bonus feature with having Surfshark is something is not available on your streaming service in your country. You just pop on that Surfshark VPN and you can probably find so much more streaming in different countries. If you want to find something like Masters of Horror, it is available on Tubi, so just select the correct country and you'll be able to watch such a great and fantastic show.
Surfshark VPN is one of the most reliable and cheapest of the VPNs out there, with up to 81% off offer when you subscribe for 24 months. Please use the link surfshark.deals/supernetwork to take advantage of this amazing deal.
You can also find the link in the show notes.
Thank you, Surfshark. Surfy shark doo 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 doo. Surfy shark doo 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 doo.
And now back to the show.